Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside just outside of New York City from an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Let's forsake the usual weather chat when it rains in New York City. And let's just talk about what a great podcast this is coming up for people, Andrew. Yeah.
No, it really is. It really is. I'm so excited about this because the voice this past week for the U.S. men's national team, Chris Whittingham, who had the call with Tony Meola on Paramount Plus, he's going to join us in just a few minutes to kind of, we'll kind of take stock of everything we saw over the last week, how things are kind of shaping up as we're now sort of in the approach to Copa America. So that should be a great conversation. He does an awesome job. He was great on the call with Tony in these two games. So that should be a lot of fun to have Chris on the program and really, really dive in on some U.S. men's national team stuff. So we'll do that, do a little bit of Euro stuff at the start of the pod. I have some England questions that I think have arose, whatever, over the last couple days or so. And then JJ, we'll do a little mailbag in the second half of the pod. I should say, as a preview to the mailbag, we're not going to go too deeply into it, but I've come to find out, and I shouldn't be surprised by this because for God's sake, it's been one of the most fascinating conversations that this country has had over the last 60 plus years or so. But if there's ever a week where I feel like we're hurting, like, what are we going to talk about? I'm just going to throw JFK assassination conspiracy theories out there, and I think the pod will be just fine. I mean, the response, I brought up that Rob Reiner podcast, and the Reddit page exploded. Separate threads. Let's talk about this.
You've opened the door now. What was the one thing I said when Newman decided to start the Reddit? What was the one thing I said? I said
conspiracy theories will thrive in here.
Please don't allow it to turn into 4chan. Now, we're some ways away from that. We're just having a nice conversation. But once you let Johnny Conspiracy in the door, the conspiracy family soon follow afterwards, and they bring in some wacky stuff. It's only a matter of time before we're monitored by the FBI, before we're associated with the Proud Boys, and ultimately before me and you are arrested on federal crimes. It's that simple.
Look, I made my point. I've stated my place now on where I fall. I've planted my flag on the JFK conspiracy theory, and my flag is firmly planted in the "there was one." That's all there is. that's it. Cat.
Yeah,
and I should I
forwarded a theory which people can go and read as well under my name, my moniker, Broline, which I'm quite happy with, and it's where I settle. And you can go over to r/caughtoffsidepod for your views on that. You can have a read of that.
And I should also say this to kind of bring it back to soccer stuff, which of course is what we're about to get into. The other thing, the Reddit community, Twitter, those things, they can sometimes be a very a very eye-opening gauge for me. Like, I don't, those things, it's great that the animals exist and I love like engaging with them and talking about stuff, but they are also very useful to us in that you guys out there listening help me to identify things that I'm not sure how interesting they are to everybody. And then when I see it explode like wildfire on a Reddit thread, I think, oh, okay, there's something here.
They're what we call them. What we call in the business sounding board.
Well, the JFK stuff, that's one thing. That is what it is. But JJ, I got to say, the conversation going on among a lot of our listeners about what has happened to Mexico is fascinating to me. Mm. And it's clearly something that is resonating with people. So when we do the mailbag a little bit later on, I guess this is sort of a tease for that. We did have some questions sort of about what's happening there and why this rivalry is becoming increasingly one-sided. There were tons of posts on it. I would, you know, anyone who's interested, go to the Reddit page and see what people had to say. But I do think that there's more there that we could probably dive into. We'll do a little bit more in the mailbag when we get to
I know. I mean, we're probably at some point due a guest, a Mexican guest, to really dig into this because, like I said, I called it a decline on the last podcast. I do think it's a decline and a precipitous one. I did not see this coming so fast. So I am happy for all voices to be heard.
Absolutely. I mean, the U.S. success in the most recent era of this rivalry, it's only one side of the story. Like, yeah, Mexico is a whole nother part of this. And it was
pointed out on the Reddit that it's okay for us to get excited about the players we have and use beating Mexico as a barometer of our progress. But there is that other side where they've fallen a lot below the standard they used to hold. So it's never one thing or another. It takes two to tango.
Right. We're not whooping up on like the Rafa Marquez, Jared Borghetti era Mexico team right now.
Even on the Luis Garcia, Jorge Campos mid-90s version. We're not even close to that.
Let's see, JJ. We'll get to Chris Whittingham in just a moment. Before that, though, we'll take a look at some of the top stories from around the world over the past few days. The Euro 24 field is set.
Yes.
After Poland, Ukraine, and Georgia round out the field of 24. Georgia in their first ever major tournament. Unbelievable scenes in the nation's capital there. A pitch invasion, but one that was that was warranted. I would say, I mean, these are the moments where I'm cool with pitch invasions. Like,
I'm good with it. This is absolutely fine. Unbelievable scenes. And look, for a lot of Americans, this isn't going to mean anything. Former Russian Republic qualifies for the European Championships. But if you've been deep in the weeds, as I have, following a team through qualification and World Cup tournaments in UEFA qualifying for years, Georgia have been this very technical, very tricky, but ultimately unsuccessful team for, I would say, the last 10 years, 15 years. Before that, they were not great. And then at the start, they were semi-decent, at least a little bit competitive. They're only going since 1992, really.
Right.
They were only accepted in by FIFA and UEFA since then. So this is absolutely massive. Willie Sanyal's team beating out the Greeks, who had done a number on Ireland twice, but the scenes were absolutely unbelievable from a US angle. There was obviously the penalties where most of the drama were, with Giakoumakis missing a huge penalty for Greece, dragging his penalty wide. But this feels good, and I know it's hard. It's very hard. We always kind of are. I always talk about, there's always some team that comes into the European Championships that I get hyped about that don't do a lot. And I'm not calling them this year's Turkey. They're definitely, I'm not giving them dark horse status or anything of that nature. But they'll be a tricky side to have in the group. They should be a tricky side to have in the group.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, they have a superstar on their team in Kvitsa Kvitskaya.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have that. And I know, I mean, I've heard you mention them for years now, because like they've always been this frustration point for Ireland, I feel like, in various qualifying campaigns. So I feel like they've been on your radar and through that, this podcast radar in a different sort of way.
They have, because there's sometimes we've shoved them aside, but it's only been like, I remember one time we beat them and we never deserved it. It was in Dublin. Never deserved it. Seamus Coleman had to do a Kvaratskhelia solo run to score. He ran down the end line and then kicked it into the net. Like, they've had bad, bad luck. And now they find themselves in Group F, which I don't know. I don't know how to view Group F yet. But it's Turkey.
It feels up for grabs, that group.
Turkey, Portugal, and the Czech Republic.
Yeah,
is where Georgia find themselves in amongst. So, again,
I mean, Portugal are obviously the class, but everything after that feels like there's a route for, you can make a case for almost any one of them.
I know, and there is a chaos scenario where I see Portugal not being good, and
that's harder for me to envision.
I know it is, but you have a lot more faith and trust and hope in a certain.
This has nothing to do with Ronaldo.
Oh, no, and Roberto Martinez as well. You love him. So no, but I'm fascinated and I'm delighted. I am delighted for Georgia because, they deserve it. They absolutely deserve it. I think they've been. It's nice that a team that was always seen as a spoiler can go to the tournament.
Yeah, delighted for Ukraine as well. Of course, with everything going on for the people of that nation.
Can I talk quickly
about Mikhailo Mudryk scoring the winner in the 84th minute? What a moment!
Yeah, can I talk quickly about that? Mudryk's goal was a lovely swept finish, the winner into the bottom corner. But Iceland hit the front with an unbelievable solo effort from Gudmundsson. Like, it was, he ran around in a circle, realized, I got nobody to pass with. I'm just going to lash this thing. Flies into the net. And then Ukraine, their equalizer, this sweeping end-to-end move, counterattack, and Zykinov, I think, I'm probably not saying that right, he curls one home. At the end of it, it's just like a really beautiful goal to watch. Great for Ukraine with everything going on. But I feel like Iceland. I know Iceland would be devastated. They had a lot of support at the game. But like in terms of UEFA, Iceland will be delighted. UEFA will be delighted with Iceland having just eliminated Israel earlier on, because UEFA did not want the political, the outside influence that would have come in had Israel gone on and maybe qualified. Now, I don't think Israel would have been good enough had they beaten Iceland to beat Ukraine. But, you know, there'll be certain people in UEFA who will be quite glad that they did not have to face or have to engage with that reality.
And then finally, bitterly disappointing defeat for Wales, losing on penalties. Ben Davies had a goal ruled out for offside.
What did you think of that?
I mean, it was unbelievably close, but he was off. So, I mean, it's one of those, we talk about them all the time, the kind of a molecular level offside, was offside. I've seen the lines drawn, the still shots, you know, that's tough.
What part was it, Andrew? Was it his foot or his
I'd have to go back and look at it again.
Yeah. Okay.
But it was clear.
The highlights I was watching did not have they didn't wait around for no lines to be drawn.
I mean, without lines drawn, without a zoom in, that's always going to be one that's too hard almost for the human eye to distinguish. Like, you have to zoom in and lines.
The lineman had his flag up, didn't he? I think the linesman had his flag up. So I don't know how he saw it. I really don't. But it was unlucky. And I don't know if your feeling from this game was Poland didn't do much.
No.
Of anything. And why do I feel like, you know, no one's guaranteed. No one has a divine right to be there. But, like, I just feel like it's going to be another tournament where the Poles go and they just underwhelm, which is every tournament. Oh, there's Poland. What are they going to do? Nothing really. Not a lot. Are you going to get excited about them before the tournament? Yeah, because they've got Lewandowski. How about now? No, they were rubbish. So, and that's kind of the way I feel about them. And I have one other learning or comment I'd like to make. Lewandowski had the first Polish penalty. Andrew, if the goalkeeper must have one foot on the line, must be rooted, may not move before the penalty is struck, how in the name of God are they allowing Lewandowski to have two stops? Those aren't pauses. Those are effing stops. He is stopping in his run-up. That should be removed. No stutter step, nothing.
That's probably how I would coach it. I would coach my players to not stutter. I feel like more often than not, when I see guys do that, I think, uh-oh, I don't like this. I would coach them to just run up and smash the hell out of the ball.
Which was most of the penalties in that shootout. There was a lot of good penalties until, Dan James.
Yeah. I'm just sad that we won't be able to have another Michael Sheen pump-up speech.
Come on, ye lads! Oh, No. Nothing gave me manufactured nationalist passion is
always a favorite of yours.
Oh, I can't. No.
So yeah, that's Euro 24. The field is set. Before we move off of this and get to Chris Whittingham to talk a little U.S. men, I did at least want to mention another high profile friendly for England at Wembley. This one against Belgium. And England forced to settle for a draw on pretty much the last touch of the ball. Jude Bellingham scored in what was like in what had become a kind of a half empty Wembley Stadium. Not everyone who bought a ticket to that game was there to see Jude Bellingham score an equalizer in the 96th minute. Kind of a cool moment that a lot of people missed.
Did they leave because they thought England aren't going to equalize, or because of the rain, or like what was the
probably a combination of England. This is kind of frustrating. I'm not really enjoying my time here. It's raining. This is a friendly. Even if they do score and I miss it, I missed a goal in a friendly. Like,
it's a good game.
It's probably a combination of those things. But like, I don't know. It's Wembley. It's England. Like, not playing at the peak of what they can be. But like, sort of this era of England is kind of, you bought a ticket to see peak England. Like, this is maybe as good as they've been since they won the damn World Cup. Like, I don't know. Stay another 10 minutes and see. That maybe that could happen, but well, whatever. I don't want to. Far be it from me, JJ, to tell people what to do with their time.
But I mean, it was an enjoyable game. By the way, those of us who are waiting for a Pickford mistake at international level, well, you got
one.
It. Yeah, definitely kicks it straight to teams.
This is the thing that I worry about with England is like, you know, I do wonder if these two games, they have two home games against two good opponents. And they don't win either of them.
No.
In a time where England are kind of expected to win every game they play, which is a big statement. Like, look, I don't know that I'll pick them against France, but like, if you did, you're not crazy. Like, that's kind of where we're at right now with England. And I think what we're coming to learn a little bit, I don't want to read too deeply into friendlies, but England are very good. They definitely are. There's no question about it. But are they good enough to outplay individual errors against other very good teams? And I think that's sort of the thing that you have to worry about. The Pickford bad pass. Lewis Dunk, weird defending. Two errors. I don't know. Two errors, two goals. And like, yeah, you can make some of those errors in qualifying against lower level opposition, but like Brazil's, Belgium's, you're going to France, Spain, whoever winds up being in European championships, can you do it against those teams and still win? They've got to eliminate those. Like, I don't know. They'll overcompensate on mistakes to a point, but in the quarters, the semis, the final, stuff can't happen.
No, it can't. We should say that the outside of the foot cross by Lukaku for Tielemans for the goal. Come on.
Awesome.
Oh, come on. Absolutely.
That whole thing was just aesthetically
gorgeous.
Perfect.
Oh, perfect. Absolutely gorgeous. We should say great night for Kobbie Mainoo. Made his debut for England. They are not leaving that international. They are really snapping this kid up. Could have had a debut goal as well. Sells made a good save from him. Yeah. Ivan Toney scored his first goal for England. Jude Bellingham doing what he does. There were some things. But you're right. The two games, if this is England's dominant period, then they have to put in a dominant performance. And we have not seen that yet. And that's the concern going into the European Championship finals.
And you can say, sure, like this was not, this may not be the England team that they're going to roll out there at Euros.
Sure.
Kane didn't play, Bukayo Saka. But like by the same token, you know, while that is true, this wasn't Belgium of 6 years ago.
No.
Like this Belgium team is good. They're definitely good. But like it's not prime Lukaku. There's no Eden Hazard there. De Bruyne, like, you know, they're at home in this era. Like we should expect a little bit. I think you can expect a little more.
Yeah, but they were the finalists in this tournament the last time round. And we were told that that was another step on development. Okay, then where's your big win? Where's your big win coming? They have to be the top team in a tournament. And no, Germany doesn't count the last time out. It doesn't. So, I'm reading an article right now. I don't want to talk too much about it, but from Jonathan Harding in DW about how the German juggernaut, it's a turning, Andrew. Things are pointing in the right direction, but we'll save that for well, that's the sense. Can you turn around a juggernaut in two days or two games rather? Not sure, but you know, that's the sense they're getting. Anything else on England there?
No, not from me.
I just wanted to talk briefly about the England kick controversy.
So help me with this, because I've seen a lot of it on social media.
Yes.
My gut, when I was reading about it and saw it, saw the flag on the back of the kit that this is all centered around, I don't want to cause a stir here. Personally,
yeah,
I don't quite see what the big deal is. However, that's just me. I'm not English. If it was an American flag that in some way was altered, I don't know that I would.
Well, I mean, ours is perpetually altered on different things, kind of stretched out or
I was a little bit, when I saw what it looked like, I was a little bit surprised by some of the outcry.
Yes. And the amount of column inches devoted to this has been staggering. So just to fill people in, the St. George's flag on the back of the collar was altered by Nike, and they say they altered it playfully as a nod to the 1966 warm-up kit that was used. So the colors are kind of, there's kind of a black in there, there's a purple, whatever.
By the way, it's such a random thing to like honor. We're going to alter the flag.
That's what Nike said.
As but remembrance Nike used, for the warm-up but Andrew, kit but in not, the 60s. Like, what? That's so weird.
But the 66 kit, it kind of makes sense, you know?
No, but the warm-up kit, I don't know. It's just weird.
I don't. Maybe just make a warm-up kit like that. But don't forget, this is the culture war era, Andrew, where everything is interpreted as either woke or lesbian or bisexual. And so a bunch of people decided that, okay, this isn't full LGBTQ+. It's bisexual. And people started, you know, screaming and shouting and getting upset to the point of like, you know, this is England, right? St. George. People died for that flag. They died for that flag. And to see this woke communist nonsense, right, on the back of our jersey, I won't stand for it. I won't. I'll tell you what, I won't watch England.
Tell me no one is saying that.
People are saying they won't buy the jersey. They won't. It's gone too far. There was this, and it was hot. It was drummed up by the usual morons, led on X by Joey Barton, cultural commentator. 11 and a half minutes for England or however much he played. But I found it all kind of, you know, just interesting. It is the culture war. So anything can be interpreted as anything. But the sense, it's also, if you think about Englishness, the English national team is kind of one of the last bastions of something I can point to and say, that's England. Like, this is England. This is what England represents. Because, you know, there's a lot of distinct identifiers of culture and identity that the English people don't have, but their football team is one of them. But it's a confused one, too. So when I was growing up, my first tournament was Italia 90. Do you know the flag that was the majority flag that was in Turin the night they played Germany in the World Cup semifinal? It was the Union Jack.
Really?
It was the Union Jack everywhere. It wasn't the St. George's flag. That's what they carried everywhere. Then I went back and I looked at some footage of the 66 World Cup final. Union Jacks. Way more Union Jacks. Hardly a St. George's flag to be seen. So somewhere along the line that changed. And I was in England as a 14-year-old for Euro 96. And all it was George's flags. Hanging out of the windows everywhere. Like there's, you know, there is a sense of like, well, what is England? Who are we? There's a real fragile sense. And there's also like Brexit, when you add in Brexit, Brexit was going to redefine. Brexit was really an argument about Englishness. It wasn't about like the Welsh, they have their own language, their own assembly, their own legislative body. The Scots have the same thing. And even Northern Ireland in its schizophrenic sectarianism, I can define a Northern Irish culture. I can define a nationalist culture there. England just doesn't have any of that. But the football team, that's what they have. They go out there, they're playing for England, the Three Lions. But it's even within the football team, it's a confused nationalism. So I think that's what set people off. But also, you know, The interesting thing about right-wing politics right now is that they tell the left that they are offended by everything. But nobody is more offended by everything than the right. Everything. Everything is lesbian. This podcast, Andrew, is woke, lesbian, and communist. Just because I've said all the words I've said in the last 10 minutes. And by the way, The Guardian, they do that brilliant, Guardian Sport do that brilliant comic strip. It's just so good. David Squires. Look at what David Squires does a much better job than me. Go look at David Squires from this week, his comic strip about this whole thing. Brilliant. Absolutely genius and certainly inspired the words I have just said.
Interesting. Oh, very interesting. All right. For what it's worth, once England played, it felt to me like that all kind of calmed down. Like there was a lot of fervor leading up to the games. And then once the football happens, we all kind of refocus on the football.
It's like you if you got really upset. You're a Philadelphian nationalist. Let's be honest. You're a complete Philadelphian nationalist. If it was slightly less of Eagles green, you'd still watch them. Even if you protested so much, you'd still watch them. My final point that I missed out on, and it's an important point. The main, I would say the main signifiers of Englishness, and I've forgotten, I really should have added this in, is the English football team. That's something they can cling to. And World War II. That is the other thing. That is two World Wars and one World Cup. That's the chant. That World War II is something that English people hang on to, hold on to, and treasure dear, even if they weren't even born within 2 decades of it. That is a massive point in the, if you want to say the decline or the continuation of Englishness.
These are generally the things that the population can rally around and be sort of unified behind. So I get it. And then one other thing, JJ, just want to mention an MLS note. Olivier Giroud appears to be in the final stages now of finalizing a deal to join LAFC.
Talk to me, Andrew. Talk to me. What's your perception of this one? Because mine is going to be very obvious.
So, I mean, look, he's still playing at a pretty high level in Serie A. 12 goals, 8 assists this season with AC Milan. Consistent. He's kind of always been sort of this like model of consistency. But he's 37. So, like, whatever the best version of him is, we've probably seen it. Now, the one thing I would say about that is he's not necessarily a player who relies on athleticism. So maybe someone like him can eke out more from these next couple of years than a guy who's going to run a ton, box to box, that kind of thing.
Are we talking Zlatan Light here?
I mean, maybe something like that. I'd be curious to see what his partnership with Denny Bawanga looks like. Bawanga can do more of that running,
legs.
And Giroud can be sort of more of the hold up play and distributor to get him into the right position. So, I mean, honestly, like, my head is sort of waging a battle with itself because there is a little bit of leaning on the MLS trope of retirement community. Like, it's hard to look at this and not feel that way a little bit, but that also doesn't mean that this won't be a successful signing for LAFC, which I do think it will be. I think it's a good move. Yeah, they have roster flexibility. They had two open DP spots. Hugo Lloris, I think, was trying to help make this move happen in talking to his fellow countrymen to come on over. So I think it'll work. I think this will work.
Yeah, I wondered about it. And then I thought, is there a sense of seeing the value in Bawanga in those years as he enters his 30s, seeing how good he's been? And also bringing in a guy, I know Bouanga doesn't play for France, he's born in France, that there's a kind of having a legend alongside him could really help, and a French legend. Maybe that was part of the thought process. Otherwise, signing 37, 38-year-old players is, I don't think it's good business.
Yeah, well, look, it's a contract that only runs for, what, like a year and a half? So it's a long-term investment. I think it will work for them. I could envision this.
And the ladies love him, man.
Well, he's an incredibly handsome human being.
Is he? Yeah.
You're not sure.
I guess he is. Yeah. I guess he is. Yeah.
I mean, if he's not, then you and I are goblins. We're ghoulish creatures. I mean, come on. He has to be handsome.
I think he is. Right. I'm just always stunned by the
I mean, the look, there's levels of this. Is he Graziano Pelle? Is he Xabi Alonso? I don't know. That's for each person to decide on.
Come
that.
On. The podcast is going gay now.
Jeez.
We're fine. We're fine.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's actually switch gears here. This was a fun week. Obviously, hoisting another trophy, having beaten arch rival Mexico in the CONCACAF Nations League final and Jamaica before that in the semifinal in incredibly dramatic fashion. Let's go back now. Let's review a lot of what went on, and let's start looking ahead as well to the next big thing to happen for the U.S. men's national team, which will be Copa America in the summer. And let's do so with the guy who called these past two games on Paramount Plus, and that was Chris Whittingham. He joins us right now to talk a little U.S. soccer. Chris, what's up, man? How are you?
JJ, Andrew, pleasure to be alongside for the first time. I tried to hit the response exactly as I did the first time, and you didn't record it.
And thank you, Chris, in the spirit of this show, calling Andrew out for his follies. That is important.
This will all be edited out in post-production. No one will ever know that this happened. I'll have an AI voice come in that sounds like Chris that'll re-record all that. Chris, before we even get into the game, I kind of just want to ask you, almost on a personal level, was that your first call of a USA-Mexico match? And if so, did it feel different at all?
So it was an interesting weekend in that respect. So this weekend was the first time I've ever worked at the US men, period. And so I never done the US men. I mean, obviously, I have followed the U.S. men's national team for years. I've been working for soccer broadcasting. I feel like I basically watched every U.S. men's game since like 2010. And so I'm incredibly well-versed. But yeah, it was my first time broadcasting it. And oddly, I felt more of that weight doing the Jamaica game than I did the Mexico game, because it was the first time, because I hadn't really prepared myself for how different it was going to feel to do a U.S. men's game. And then it felt like, as the game was going on and as the U.S. are struggling to find goals and find chances, oh no, is this going to be like the Trinidad and Tobago game from 2017, when it's going to be remembered as one of those all-time bad moments? And you know, Phil Shane's call of that night is very memorable. And are you accurately capturing what could feel like a seminal moment for Greg Berhalter, the program, this incredibly negative thing that is going to swirl around the team? So I actually felt it more on Thursday, and I really tried to get in my head to not be as odd or as thinking about the occasion on Sunday. So I tried to call it as normal as possible, and it felt pretty normal.
Does it help, Chris, as a commentator? It's something I've never done. Well, that's not true. I dabbled a bit, but it does it help when it's so, I don't want to say one-sided, but when Mexico, it wasn't like end-to-end. It wasn't like, oh, there's a Mexican chance, there's a U.S. chance. Like, there was so very few moments for Mexico. Does that almost help a commentator get into his rhythm in a big game?
I would say generally a better game does give you better rhythm. I think the more chances and the more normal, I would say, build-ups are, like, and I know that sounds weird, but you like, as a commentator, 10 to 15 pass moves, so that you have the time over the course of the move to see everything, build your flow, and it all reaches a crescendo when a goal or a big chance comes. So I think the game being a bit helter-skelter doesn't really help, but yet I really felt like I was in a flow, and part of that was like kind of how I approached the game and all of that. But a lot of it also just had to do with, I just felt like Tony Meola and myself were just on top of everything we needed to be on top of from the opening whistle and hitting all the big talking points and all of that. And then the game kind of played its role in that as well. So yeah, I think obviously we are more familiar with the United States. That's not an excuse. I think we tried to do like the most amount of research possible on Mexico. We did their semifinal on Thursday as well, so we had just seen them play live as well. So I feel like we were just as prepared for if Mexico were in complete control of that game. But I do think that the U.S. having superiority in the game throughout does help a little bit.
I haven't really engaged much with Meola as co-commentator. Was he a steady co-pilot? He seems to me to be a solid guy. He's not going to throw something mental at you and completely put you off your game.
No, for sure. I think he is a pro's pro, has called tons of games before, and I would just say is very perceptive, but not in like the way that it's sort of, here, I'm going to show you everything that I see in the game. It's, I'm going to present the points that need to be presented in the moments in which they are needed. And right. So he is just always right on top of everything. I had met Tony before, but we had not called games before this weekend. So it was really cool just to kind of have, like you said, that very steady presence and someone who just just calls a very normal game, but still one that I think brings a ton of insight to the viewers. Like, we were kind of going through the checklist after the game. Did we hit this? Did we hit that? Did we hit this? And I feel like we hit absolutely everything that we needed to in the moments in which we needed to. So I felt really good about the broadcast.
Chris, as a, I guess, a natural transition point from your call of the broadcast to the game itself, what kind of goal do you enjoy calling more? Is it like, I know you've done Inter Miami games. Is it like the messy, mazy run through a defense, or just an absolute 40-yard laser like the one you got from Tyler Adams?
I mean, you can't be choosy. I mean, all goals are great, right? And I think in some ways that goal from Tyler Adams comes as such a shock that you're not really fully prepared for it. And even as he's shaping up to hit it, you see all the time the technique of, all right, he's going to, you know, just from the body language that there's going to be an effort from 35 yards coming. And usually what I kind of do in those moments is figure out kind of the register you want to hit when it inevitably sails over the bar. Like, how much are you really going to give it when his foot hits the ball, because ultimately you kind of know that in all likelihood it's not going to work. So I realized that I used the same words, he's going for it, for both that goal and Lionel Messi's first free kick goal for Inter Miami. I did that game for radio and I used that exact same expression. So it was interesting that, like, it's one of those where, all right, he's going for it, let's see what happens. And yeah, then you just, you know, you try and go to a 10 on the Richter scale and just completely captured this moment. And yeah, but like I said earlier, in terms of preference, if I had a preference, it would be pass, 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 great through ball, goal, because you've built your way through it and you're ready for that moment, as opposed to, I think in that game, chances were of such short supply that you didn't really feel like this was going to be the one, and that's the moment when you least expect it. And that's kind of the beauty of commentating soccer, is that you never know what the moment is going to be. You could be midway through a story. You could be just saying the players' names and build up, and all of a sudden, the whole game just comes to life in a matter of seconds. And that was very much the case with that Adams goal.
Chris, much is made all the time about how whenever we play Mexico, it's an away fixture, regardless of whether it's on U.S. soil or Mexican soil. What did it feel like in Jerry World to you? Did it feel that way?
Yeah, it was a very pro-Mexico crowd. There were a lot of Mexican fans there, and I feel like there was enough of a U.S. presence for when the U.S. did positive things. And I feel like it was interesting. We were talking in the build-up to the game, and I think we even said this on air, that keeping the crowd in control was a big part of the U.S. game plan. So yeah. I feel like it was interesting that was a big part of, I think, the first opening 20 minutes. And I thought the U.S. did incredibly well to do that, because we saw it on Thursday night when Mexico played Panama. There were these moments they would hit out in transition, and the Mexican fans in attendance, and they are very good football supporters, when things open up, and in particular, things open up for Chucky Lozano, who came off the bench in the game on Thursday and then started on Sunday, he is no question the fan favorite amongst the Mexico supporters. And so when the game opens up for him, it's like you don't want to call it a hush because it's obviously of noise, but this like kind of wave of noise comes through the ground and they're all like ready and excited for him to do something special.
A murmur,
A murmur goes through the stadium. And it's so interesting that Mexico didn't really give the fans much to cheer about. And I think it's kind of what the Mexico crowd was looking for. And I think it's kind of what Jaime Lozano wants to do as the Mexico manager, is kind of bring back that Mexican identity and realizing the moments that the fans respond to, I think, better than maybe Tata Martino, Diego Coca did, because they're Argentinian managers. I think Jaime Lozano wants to bring that sort of Mexican character back to the team, and yet they just weren't able to do it against the U.S. because, as has been talked about plenty in the aftermath, they're just not as good.
No, they're not. And one of the reasons for that was on full display in this game was Gio Reyna. I mean, given how difficult this last year and a half or so has been for him, this was an important week, I think, for that guy. And if we can agree that this was a statement performance, which it was, he took home CONCACAF Nations League Player of the Tournament, then I guess the question I would ask is, if it was a statement performance, what's the statement that he made, in your opinion?
Definitely to Nottingham Forest that I need to play, or that I should be playing, or that give me a bigger role than I've had before. But certainly within the national team, it's I think for as good as Christian Pulisic has been, that Gio Reyna can almost be a more talismanic-like figure because he plays centrally and because a lot of the play can go through him. It was interesting, the role in which he was deployed on Sunday in particular, playing so deep and helping with the buildup and coming back to help Tyler Adams get the team moving forward. So much can go through him, and he has this vision and this creativity that the U.S. has not really had much of before. Mm-hmm. And so for, certainly that I think that statement was for the national team. He is an incredibly important piece independent of his club form. But it has to be a statement, if not to Forrest and if not to Dortmund, then some club somewhere who is scouting and watching this game, that Gio Reyna can be that player for your team at a high, high level. Because, yes, maybe Mexico aren't as good as they've always been, and maybe CONCACAF is not the highest level of the international game, but this is still an incredibly high-level stage to have done this at, and I feel like he just has to be able to be useful for somebody. It doesn't make any sense that Dortmund and Forrest have only given him two league starts since the last World Cup. That's 16 months ago, and he's only started two league games since. He's just, he's a better player than that. And some club has to be able to find a role for him.
Gosh, Chris, when you say it like that, it's insane.
We did the research in the buildup. It was 39 league minutes for Forrest and two league starts since the World Cup.
God almighty, that's, yeah. It's interesting for me coming out of this tournament. I would say going in, there was, and I don't know if you agree with me or not, like, so there was a sense that the midfield three, I honestly felt it was solidified in Greg's mind. It would be Musa, McKennie, Adams. And there was a little murmur going into the tournament about, well, you know, when is Adams going to be fit? Maybe we shouldn't start him. Johnny Cardoso is the soup du jour. Get him in there. And Adams kind of came up with the goods in limited minutes. It must be said he did very well considering he was on a kind of a pitch count. And now I'm wondering if the conversation has changed and that we are discussing Yunus Musa as maybe the odd man out in that three. What would you say to that, Chris?
So for me, because you have to fit Reyna into the midfield positions, I think Greg kind of always wanted to fit him into a wide position. He's tried him out there before, but ultimately he cannot exert his influence on the game from a wide position. He's got to do it from the middle. And for me, the way that he used Reyna next to Adams in the base of the midfield for so much of the game, I think is instructive of what is Greg Berhalter's, I think, biggest dilemma, which is he has Tyler Adams, who is a brilliant defensive player and makes a lot of the system work. I was actually listening to a conversation that from the UK about Wales, and apparently Robert Page, their manager, said, we need to step up our athleticism. Look at how athletic the USA were at the last World Cup. We couldn't match them athlete for athlete in midfield. You look at the sprinting numbers of the World Cup, the US ran more than any team at the tournament. And so I think having that element, it makes the US system work, but Greg Berhalter, I think, fairly clearly doesn't think that Adams has enough in his possession abilities to be a single six in build-up. And so you do have to have someone that drops alongside him. That's why I don't think Musa is necessarily gone, but I do find interesting that it was Reyna in this game who is coming deep, then asked to go forward and play the creative role, because I think Berhalter is constantly trying to shift the team so that he can get Adams that help in the build-up phase and then still have the attacking ability in the final third. So I do think that Musa definitely has his role to play, but this was always kind of my thing before the last World Cup, which is there have to be players that get left out. I remember Brendan Aaronson was informed before the last World Cup, and you have to make decisions, right?
Yes.
And that's international football. And I think Musa, particularly his role for Milan, is not as a starter right now. He's going to have to get, I think, a bigger role at club level and continue to progress to kind of unseat Reyna at this moment in time.
Chris, it was just interesting what you said. You know, I understand what you mean about Reyna dropping deep, but there's an interesting kind of wrinkle that came from that very kind of conversation about him going back and playing a deeper role from your colleague, Jesse Marsh. And I'm just wondering if Berhalter has, you know, he's defeated Claudio Reyna. He's got through that maze. And now the final boss is actually on the CBS desk, Jesse Marsh. Picking holes at everything he says, because that was a point he made at the on halftime, and I'm sure you've heard it since, where he kind of made you know, you need him closer to the box. You need him in the penalty box. Having him back there hitting 40-yard Hollywood balls, diagonals, how much of a help is that? So I'm just wondering, first of all, about that tactical wrinkle, and also, is Jesse Marsh now his arch nemesis?
Yeah, I'll answer the first point first, which is I do think that that wrinkle is... I think it's an interesting point that Jesse brings up, which is that it's not where Gio naturally plays. And we saw, based off the assist that he created in the semifinal in that extra time period to Haji Wright, that he does operate better, closer to goal, that you're best taking advantage of his skill set. But I still think that Greg Berhalter wants to see the build-up phase executed correctly. Mm. And Reyna right now represents the player in the team that can kind of most have that happen. So I think it's a lot to ask of Reyna to both come back and help with the build-up, go forward and create the chances, and also provide some kind of defensive cover as that kind of maybe second striker in a 4-4-2 defensive look, or even in that midfield in that 4-3-3. So I think it's a lot to ask of Reyna, but I feel like, in some ways, haven't a lot of U.S. fans wanted Reyna to have this bigger role within the team? And now Berhalter is giving it to him, and I thought he handled it really well against Mexico. To your second point of criticism, I thought that whole thing was really interesting and ultimately good. I don't know. I kind of like the fact that there are different philosophical debates happening within U.S. soccer, that there are different American coaches that see the game differently, that present their viewpoint publicly, and Greg Berhalter has his, and Jesse Marsh has his. And I do think that debate, drama, those kinds of things are the things that footballing nations have all the time. You listen to the English conversation about Gareth Southgate, it is nonstop about this player playing here and that player playing there, and should we play like this and should we play like that? The biggest footballing nations always have that conversation happening all the time. So I'm here for it. I like the fact that these are two accomplished managers that see the game a little differently, and they're presenting their views in public. I hope that neither of them really take it that personally. Having spoken to Jesse, I don't really think he does. I just think he's saying what he thinks.
And I honestly think that Greg, in responding to Jesse, wasn't really sending a message to Jesse. He was sending a message to Gio Reyna after the Jamaica game, say that hey, this wound is healed. I've got your back always. And this was just a nice, easy way to do it without ruffling too many feathers.
I agree. Yeah, and I think that level of support for Reyna is a very good thing for him at this moment, because you want to create the feeling that I think Greg Berhalter deserves a ton of credit for, which is when players come to the national team, they enjoy it. They want to be there, and they want to be around these guys that are incredibly supportive. And I don't know if necessarily Reyna felt that at the World Cup, and so you do have to recapture that. And thus, I think, Berhalter comes out and says those things, and I think the team has gotten behind him because they realize that they are better with him, and they have to continue to integrate him into the squad.
Listen, if we all stay away from business conferences where we talk about management and leadership, we'll be fine. We'll do just fine.
Just no. Just be aware when the Chatham House rule is in effect. That's the important thing. Chris, just a couple more for you here. You've been super generous with your time. One thing I do feel like needs to be mentioned is this was a really fun week. The U.S. beat Mexico in a cup final. They played well enough. Gio Reyna had a nice redemptive. Like there were a lot of fun storylines here. What we shouldn't forget is that it was kind of a miracle that they were even in that game in the first place. The Jamaica match was bad. It was not good, and it took an extremely fortunate bounce with the last touch of the ball in regulation for it to even get to extra time. It was a good week. It wasn't a perfect week. What are some of the concerns maybe on the forefront of your mind coming out of this as we look ahead to Copa America?
I think, first off, it's an excellent point, and there is definitely a world in which that ball doesn't come off of Corey Burke, in which this is a 1 out of 10 international window, and all the pressure is heaped on the Greg Berhalter, and it's kind of fascinating, in not just this, but in the world of sport, how these tiny moments can be such inflection points. And I know that like there's a vocal contingent, certainly on social media, fans that almost wish that ball didn't come off of Corey Burke so that we could have a more honest... I almost wish that it didn't happen so that we could have, in their view, a more honest... And I feel like it would be off balance. Like I've always kind of been among the more sympathetic to Berhalter people out there from the last few years. But yeah, I mean, it is definitely worth noting that the U.S. came out of that game incredibly flat. They didn't create a ton. And I think Greg Berhalter even said it himself after the game. When we go up against 5-4-1 low block defensive teams, we struggle. And it's interesting that a lot of the things that he says are the problem are theoretically things that he would address in training, or, you know, because he talks about speed of play, movements, runs. You know, he talks about how Flair and Balogun's got to make more hard runs in the penalty area and things like that. And it just feels like, well, is there a disconnect between what you're saying in public and what's said on the training ground? Or do you feel like the players just aren't doing it, don't have the energy to do it, don't have the chemistry of having played together for enough time, like, you know, in the buildup to a game, to really go through those patterns? So in my view, it's interesting that there is that disconnect between how Greg Berhalter feels the U.S. struggle against low blocks and why they are struggling against low blocks when he has been the manager for such a long period of time. But that's always been the case. And I think in general, the U.S. struggle on a few accounts, one of which that has always worried me for, you know, going back years when, you know, it's always interesting that the talk is about which striker will play for the U.S. and which striker best suits the national team. And I feel like the U.S.'s biggest issue is getting striker service. And that's been the case for me for years. And how many strikers have been chewed up and spit out by the system where you go, ah, that player is not good enough, that player is not good enough, and you're blaming the individual and not blaming the structure that gets the striker chances? Because Balogun didn't really do much on Thursday. Haji Wright starts in the number nine role, didn't do much in that role, and it's because there is a consistent lack of service into the strikers that allow them to create chances. So there are a lot of things that for me can continually be worked on that are slightly papered over by the fact that that a ball came off of Corey Burke and allowed the U.S. to play a final against Mexico and create this good feeling again. But these are issues that will not be papered over when you're playing friendlies against Colombia and Brazil in the build-up to Copa America, playing Uruguay in the group stage. And at some point, the U.S. is going to have to come up with a big result against one of those teams to assuage these concerns.
I just want to pull on the thread a little bit more of the number nine that you talk about there for the U.S., because you're right, that's emerged as really kind of the hot button thing for this team right now as to who's going to occupy that position. I think going into this last week, we were all sort of under the impression, okay, Josh Sargent's playing well, you know, Haji Wright's playing well, but this is still Balogun's position. Didn't play great against Jamaica, obviously, was supplanted by Haji Wright for the next game. Is this now kind of just, we're going to ride the hot hand at that position, and that whoever it is in any given moment, that's who it's going to be? Or do you still see this as Balogun's job?
I still see it as Balogun's job, but if Haji Wright is on the kind of form that he's on, where he scores two goals in a semifinal and scores an FA Cup quarterfinal goal that sends Coventry City to an FA Cup semifinal, then he's going to be given that opportunity, just as I think a lot of players will be given that opportunity. But again, in my view, you can talk about how, oh, Haji Wright was quiet in the 70 minutes that he started against Mexico, but what opportunities were really on for him? There was nothing really there. And I don't feel like it takes a special kind of number nine to grab a game by the scruff of the neck, take four players on and go and score a goal. Like, it really is system dependent. And so I do think that Balogun had, I would say, one chance to provide an assist. I don't think put enough pace in that ball to Pulisic in the game against Jamaica. But other than that, like, was generally starved of it. So that's my feeling is that you can put any player in there in the current pool. You can put Brandon Vasquez in there. You can put Haji Wright, Ricardo Pepi, Josh Sargent, Valerian Balogun, countless other players that we haven't named. And I don't feel like any one of them is going to solve the problem of number nine scoring goals until the system is more catered to get them chances, whether that's putting more crosses in, whether that's getting into cutback positions, whatever the case may be. The system has to get them those chances. Otherwise, a lot of players are going to go for runs of games without scoring goals.
I'm pumped for Copa America, though. I genuinely am. This is my final question for you, Chris. What's your excitement level at? Because I think this could be a lot of fun.
For sure. And I think those two friendlies beforehand will be interesting, too, if they can get victories against Colombia or Brazil. But yeah, I think anytime you can see the U.S. play big-time knockout games against big-time level of opposition, it's such an opportunity. You get such a big chance to create memorable moments, to create the kind of moments that give you the positivity before 2026, because that ultimately, I think, is going to be a huge thing for this entire national team program. You want the country to feel, going into that tournament, that the U.S. have a chance. And that is the opportunity that is before the national team come this summer, is can you get the country excited about hosting the World Cup, not just because it's the biggest sporting event in the world and you get to see the biggest international soccer stars coming to your city, but because the U.S. have a genuine chance to do something, whether that's go to a semifinal, go to a final, go to a quarterfinal, whatever you set that bar at, you want that level of encouragement going into that tournament to be like, we can do this. Like, let's go out and do something incredible that will go down in the history books of this country. And I feel like that is a lofty goal, but the U.S. have to give their fans some kind of reason to hope. And I feel like that is the opportunity that really, you know, even before you get to the knockout rounds is there. When you play two friendlies against two big South American countries, another big South American country in the group stage, albeit the group could potentially be decided by them, but that level of opportunity is there.
Yeah, should be a ton of fun. Last one for you, just to kind of move a little bit off of U.S. men. I do have one Inter Miami question for you. I know you've done radio work for them. You've called a bunch of their games. You have a pretty good finger on the pulse of Miami and the sports scene there. So as a general question, how much of a soccer city is it right now? Like I know the Dolphins are huge, the Heat are huge, but if I gave you like a blank ticket and said this could be redeemed at any Miami sporting event right now, is the average Miami sports fan redeeming that at an Inter-Miami game?
I don't know. It's a really interesting question because, I mean, I know that, like, South Florida, generally not known as an ice hockey town, but the Florida Panthers are also doing incredibly well right now. I think right now, because of, like, that state of flux with Messi playing or not playing, because he's injured, I think that's an interesting conversation. But for sure, I think it's certainly up there with, you know, the biggest events. I think right now in terms of like hottest ticket, like price wise, I think it actually is the hottest ticket in town right now in South Florida. So yeah, that level of expectation is always there. And Miami, by virtue of its demographics, is such a big soccer city because there is a huge section of the population that the so-called American sports, your footballs, your basketballs, your baseballs, your hockeys, don't even reach because there are enormous numbers of South Americans that live in South Florida where soccer is their only sport. I think once they move into downtown Miami and play next to the airport, which will happen either next year or the year after, we'll only capture that even further. But yeah, I think there is a huge number of people that still feel like going to see Messi is an enormous attraction as they, you know, get to, you know, the MLS Cup playoffs and, you know, maybe even go further in CONCACAF Champions Cup. These big games still capture an enormous amount of attention. Yeah, I mean, that it's still a huge deal that any night, any given night in South Florida, you could potentially go see the greatest player ever in your own backyard.
Pretty cool. Yeah. Chris, this was awesome. We got to do it again. I'm sure we'll talk to you as the season progresses in MLS and when the U.S. reconvene for Copa America. You guys were awesome on the call of Paramount Plus.
Appreciate
it was,
that.
It was great stuff. So if that was your debut for the U.S., I hope it's the first of many, many more. Chris Whittingham, thanks so much, man.
Much appreciated, guys.
Chris Whittingham. Great stuff. He was awesome. Him and Tony Miola on the call for Paramount Plus. They're great. Chris does awesome work. Look forward to talking with him again in the not so distant future. JJ, let's go ahead. We'll take a break. Come back on the other side. A few more things to do. We got a nice mailbag here. A little bit of some Mexico questions from people. Also, I have a surprise for you. But the Athletic did their annual MLS general manager survey. So I'm going to run through a couple of these and see if you can guess what the,
you said surprise. I thought something like a gift.
I view this as a gift. I would hope that you and everyone out there listening would do the same. More Caught Offside still to come.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Oh, back now. Caught Offside. JJ, we'll get to the mailbag in mere moments. But before that, I sent you, just before we started recording, I sent you a story that I came across. Craven Cottage, a small venue, but a venue that I really like. Kind of a quaint, you know, picturesque, right on the Thames. Shad Khan, the owner of Fulham is looking to make some refurbishments, I guess, to Craven Cottage, one of which would include a rooftop deck pool.
For who? For, like, that you could see the field from it. Like they have in Jacksonville.
Kind of. Now it's up higher. Like the one in Jacksonville, the one, you know, in Arizona at where the Diamondbacks play, Chase Field, those I think have a little bit clearer view of a view. This is sort of like high up and on a diagonal from the drawing
trashy.
I saw.
It's so
I mean, look,
there's no need for it.
Well, that's the thing, is like February in London, like who's using this? What is this for? Like, are they going to have like?
Did a 7-year-old design it? Oh man, be so cool! Or maybe a 10-year-old as well. Man, it'd be so cool! I'm going to build a stadium, right? It's going to have a shark tank and then a swimming pool, and then there's going to be a fun slide. Instead of going onto the pitch through the tunnel, you slide down the slide. Like what the? What kind of?
Now, when I should say this? when I sent this to you, I knew that, like the PFM, the proper football man that you are, this idea would send you into conniptions.
Listen, I don't even allow cheerleaders on my soccer.
Yeah, I mean, you make fun of PFM, but you are
PFMs are important.
You are.
They give us a guideline from which we should not stray too much.
Well, okay, let me ask you this then. So the pool, right. You're out on the pool. You don't like it.
Can I also just say I'm out on the pool. Because, no, I'm in on the pool, but only if they... Don't forget, they weren't allowed to touch part of that stadium because it's a listed building, because they think Queen Elizabeth I was back there in the 16th century hanging out, right? Yeah. So the cottage, they're not allowed to touch. But we can put a hot tub in, right? Okay, then I want a person to man that hot tub at all times dressed as Elizabeth I. I want to go into the hot tub and sit down beside Elizabeth I. That's my concession.
All right. Kind of like how when you go to Rome, like when you're outside the Colosseum, there's 1,000 guys dressed up as like gladiators, like somebody to really kind of get you in the mood of where you're at.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want them to Craven Cottage. I want their official mascot to become Queen Elizabeth I.
Okay.
And make it a saucy one as well.
In addition to this, I believe that they are... they're including 2 Michelin star dining experiences, the one called the Gourmet and one called the Brasserie.
This is not for the ordinary football fan. Like Fulham, I've said this before about Fulham. Fulham is not a football club that really is trying to embrace. It's like a working class fan group, or not even working class, just a regular fan group. Like their ticket prices. The biggest controversy about Fulham going into the season was their exorbitantly priced tickets for a team that is not competing at the top of the Premier League.
Well, people should know, for anyone not familiar with the geography, Fulham, you would say, is probably in like the most posh part of London.
Exactly. And that's why it often falls in. It's like rich American tourists. Rich people in Fulham. I guess that's the kind of stuff they want. Hot tubs and Michelin star restaurants. What's wrong with Bovril?
Here we go.
Sausage roll.
Here we go.
Bovril, sausage roll. Match program. Scarf. Crunching tackle.
I'll say this about the Michelin star restaurants.
Why do you need
this? As part of the game day experience, don't need. Not necessary. Don't need it. Would rather go to the bar, watch the game. However, I don't think that it's so terrible that like during the summer, like, hey, that's kind of a cool place to go out to a really nice meal. Like, yeah, there's not a game going on, but like, where are we going to go out to dinner tonight? How about the Michelin star rated restaurant at Craven Cottage? You know what? That's kind of cool, actually. Sure.
I know.
What's wrong with that?
I know who and what you are. So imagine the reality in which you and Amanda.
Hey, wedding anniversary. What do you think? Well, we both love soccer. Wouldn't it be cool? Yeah, there's no game, but let's go to a Michelin star restaurant at a famous Premier League ground.
You shut your mouth. If you lived in London, right, and you lived in that part of London, and say your Tottenham fandom never happened, and you were in the Fulham hinterland, and you started supporting Fulham, you would have her there at that restaurant for everything, every family occasion, absolutely everything. Yeah, you'd be like, your relationship would crumble based on the fact that you'd spend all your time at the cottage, you know?
There's worse places to go out to dinner than a Premier League stadium.
And you're eating. I can imagine you eating. And you go, oh, Amanda, I need to use the bathroom. Andrew. No, I do. I need to use the bathroom. Andrew, are you going down to the dressing rooms again?
No. It's picturesque. It's on the river. It's romantic. I don't hate it. The pool. Look, the pool's another thing because I don't know when that's getting used because it's cold. But the restaurants, I'm okay with that. All right. Mailbag, JJ.
God.
This comes from
pod.
This comes from Saris Musson. He said, I'm going to throw this out. I'm not even sure whether I'm right. Is Mexico's decline that precipitous, or is the USA's ascension that stark? If Mexico had won, say, half of the games versus the US since the pandemic, would we really say that they are in free fall? The idea that Mexico might not be a proper tune-up was unthinkable during World Cup qualifying, let alone 5 years ago. It's just crazy. The focus is LOL Mexico, which granted was also my reaction, and not the depth quality of players the US have right now.
Can't it be both?
It is definitively both.
Yep.
That is my viewpoint. I don't want to be weak down the middle guy, but it is both things are clearly happening. The US is in a moment right now where we have a lot of good players playing at fairly high levels around Europe. So we can see that this is a good moment in U.S. soccer. We can all agree on that. Conversely, for Mexico, where are the stars? I mean, like, I don't mean this as an offense to Edson Alvarez, but if it's a Mexican team and Edson Alvarez is like clearly their best player, I'm not afraid of that team. No. I'm just not. And, you know, it's not to say kind of in conjunction with this, I want to read the next post as well, because it sort of speaks to this. Comes from Effort Merchant, who writes, high Liga MX salaries have become a catch-22 for top Mexican players. They can stay in Liga MX earning a high paycheck while not developing, or fight to leave by running their contract down and forcing their way to Europe, sometimes for lower wages. I think there's also a coaching volatility continuity issue with Mexico happening because of the chaotic hot seat the Mexican manager position has become. I'm not the most knowledgeable about how the manager is appointed, but I've heard it's voted on and approved by Liga MX owners. The outcomes are highly contested and political, and the manager is always a couple of losses from the sack. Having to be always in win-now mode, they're forced to favor the veterans and won't develop young talent, unfortunately. Hopefully enough losses will force change at the federation level.
I don't think they're producing the players, though. I see this point, and Effort Merchant does make a good point about them not going abroad, but like, they're not producing the players, and the ones that they have are struggling to get time at the top clubs that they're there at. Like, I mean, like I see, like you said, a holding or a mostly defensive center midfielder like Alvarez, okay, cool. Like, he's a quality player. West Ham have invested. They're happy with their investment, certainly happier with their investment than they are with Calvin Phillips. But, like, that's not going to win you games. Talk to me about center forward. I mean, nothing.
No, it's just not. It's not a threatening squad. It's just.
Remember
not.
When they had Lozano and Tecatito, and then Hector Herrera in the center of the midfield, and they just seemed. You can't make Hector Herrera younger, and it's harder to kind of replicate that kind of impact that he had. But like, you were talking about Rafa Márquez. They're not creating those kind of players. They're not bringing those players through.
Yeah, I do think it's. I mean, this is such a sweeping comment. We really have to have somebody on who has a depth of knowledge on the inner workings of what's going on here. But it does feel like there's a developmental gap that has occurred, and maybe it's a temporary one. We talked about it with the U.S. when they didn't qualify for the 2018 World Cup. It seemed like there was just kind of a lost generation in there, which then a couple years down the road, it's fixed. Maybe Mexico are just in one of those valleys right now, and maybe there is something on the horizon, but I don't know. It's not clear to me who those names are of young superstar Mexican talent. You know, it's interesting, this idea of the high wages in Liga MX preventing players from going to Europe, and it keeps them in the comfort zone of playing in their home country as opposed to challenging themselves going elsewhere. It's weird because I feel like it's almost looking into the future of what could be an unforeseen problem in MLS in terms of the MLS U.S. men's national team relationship. Like, we want all of our guys playing in Europe. You know, I like MLS. I want the league to thrive and succeed, of course, but ultimately if our guys are going to improve, it seems like they have a better chance of doing that if they go to play in Europe. But as MLS increases from a financial standpoint and this partnership with Apple, more cash is injected and, you know, could that happen here where guys, like, Miles Robinson, it happened kind of with Clint Dempsey. He could have stayed in Europe, but he chose to leave Tottenham and go to the Sounders.
But that listen.
Michael Bradley.
But it's already happening as we speak right now, today. Or rather, yesterday. Tom Bogert, breaking. Manchester City and Philadelphia Union have agreed to terms on a deal for U.S. wonder kid Kevin Sullivan, sources say. He stays in Philly until age 18. Sullivan is 14, finalizing the richest homegrown deal in MLS history. 14. Union keeps big sell on. This is what's happening now. Now, might he be an outlier? Will we see like a slew of these guys? The very nature of the development academies, the systems in U.S. soccer, I'm talking in MLS and outside of MLS, and the interest in this country in soccer, we're going to see a lot more of this. It's not all going to be blockbuster, but this is going to be happening a lot more. Richest homegrown deal in MLS history at 14. So there you go. Yeah. And a city all over that one. And I'm glad they came to a compromise because it was talking he was going immediately. But MLS will be in a fight to keep its homegrown stars for sure.
The other thing with Mexico too, like they do have players who are in Europe, you know, like their goalkeepers in Serie A. Johan Vasquez is at Genoa. Cesar Montes is in La Liga. Jorge Sanchez at FC Porto. We talked about Edson Alvarez. Like they do have guys who are over there. Lozano, obviously, at Napoli. I wonder if it's, you know, maybe it's more of a depth thing. Once you get past like the first like seven for that team, it's sort of like, okay, well,
I think so.
Now what? I mean, the U.S. run pretty deep right now in terms of guys who are playing at clubs around Europe. It's could have been the whole squad. I mean, Miles Robinson was the only one preventing it from being the whole squad. And there are people who thought it could have been just as easily, you know, Mark McKenzie or something. And there's the coaching thing also I think about. But the only thing with that I would say, while yes, it does feel like there is a volatility among coaching there, that they do change quickly, you know, look back. It kind of has been that way for a while.
Yeah, they've been trigger happy with that.
Yeah, like I was looking at it. Now, look, some of this, I don't have the exact breakdown of who was on an interim basis or not, but in the 10 years from 2000 to 2010, Mexico had 7 different managers. In the 14 years since, Mexico have had 7 different managers. Like, it's kind of been that way for this entire, you know, since the year 2000. So I don't know if I can put it all down to, you know, they change managers, so there's no continuity. I don't know. I don't know if I would say
I that. Don't think you can at international level. I mean,
it feels like a development thing. I know that's like an easy, broad statement to make, but kind of how it feels to me. Let's see. Continuing here, Nicholas Rodriguez writing to us on Instagram, Caught Offside Pod. Why do you all think Reyna is struggling at his club? Because he does exceptionally well with the U.S. men's national team. Mm. I think he's our only creative attacking player. Thank you, Nicholas. To that question, I would say, why is he struggling at his club? For the first answer, the easy one is fitness and injury. I mean, it's just robbed him of a lot of the past couple years. And it's unfortunate because he hasn't really been able to get momentum going. He hasn't been able to play long enough to really impress a coach. And he's been at a club in Borussia Dortmund that has a lot of good players. They're really good. However, as I continue to think about it, my second reason for why he has struggled at his club is I don't know. So I was reading a post this morning on the Borussia Dortmund blog, Fear the Wall. This is by Paul Johnson, who he's not an American fan. But he in there says he pays attention to Reyna a lot because he says the fan community that he's surrounded by consists of many American fans. But he himself is not necessarily any U.S. bias. And so the purpose of his piece was to try to determine why Reyna hasn't played for Dortmund. And he goes through it. And as he's kind of going through his points, it feels like as he's writing, it's becoming a little murkier. And, you know, he's trying to come up with more answers. And finally, at the end, in this piece, he says, I came into this article hoping I'd have a little more to say that might at least resemble answers. But the more I've thought this through, the more confused I am. I don't know what is wrong with Gio Reyna. I don't even know if there's anything wrong with him. I know he's a young lad and can't afford to continue not playing regular minutes. Even the guys who are like highly attuned to what's going on at Dortmund, who aren't necessarily having American bias, like here at Fear the Wall at the Borussia Dortmund blog, they're not really sure either. I don't know if I have a great answer here.
I'm pretty sure going on, like, obviously I'm not at training sessions.
but like, first of all, who signed him? That's the first question that I would ask. It doesn't feel like a Nuno signing. He's working with Gestifute right now, so obviously that's the link that's got him to Nottingham Forest. And how did that come about? It seemed to be pretty late. There was some back and forth. Was he supposed to go to Marseille? He ends up there. Okay, fine. Look at that front four that they played against Luton Town. Chris Wood is the central striker. He's a number nine. He's huge. He's a classic number nine. He's not getting in there. It's not where he plays anyway. Back end of the midfield, that's not where he's getting in. And the three ahead of the two sitting midfielders, Anthony Elanga, Morgan Gibbs-White, Divock Origi. What have they got? What have they got? First of all, Morgan Gibbs-White has done well for Nottingham Forest.
He's a very good player, yeah.
So he's not going to get rid of him. Alanga's got huge pace, and so has Origi. Like, Reina doesn't have those attributes. So he just seems like a bad fit. And you look, who else could come in his place that's off the bench? Callum Hudson-Odoi. He's ahead of him in the pecking order. It just seems like a physically and tactically bad fit. It might be that simple.
Well, yeah. Look, I'm not suggesting that Reina... Look, we said when the move to Nottingham Forest happened, it didn't look on paper like a good idea because it might be the only spot on the field where Nottingham Forest were in decent shape, were in positions that Reina would typically play. So I get it. I mean, again, the article I read was coming more from the Dortmund perspective, which is a club prone to playing young players and developing young players. I'm not saying that Reina should be starting at these places. Borussia Dortmund are one of the best clubs in the world. I'm just surprised he can't get a minute.
No.
Like that, you know, and by the way, when he has had some opportunities in the past, I mean, look, we make fun of it all the time, but like the last game of the season last year with it all on the line for Dortmund, he came in then, had two assists.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he goes off to his national team. He plays well for the U.S. I'm a little thrown that he can't play anywhere. I don't know. This summer is obviously going to be massive for him, not just for Copa America, but who decides that they want to utilize this kid.
I also think as well, we've seen him in his best moments have come in international football against Jamaica's B team, and against the Mexican side in decline. Now, does that mean he's not talented? No, it doesn't. But he may not be of Premier League level. He may not be of that level. Like you said, he might be somewhere, he might find himself at a mid-table team in Ligue 1 and be perfectly serviceable player, a quality player, you know. But like, there's so much that goes into being a footballer. And like what we discussed with Chris, the athleticism part, that's such a huge thing now.
One other thing I would have to bring up here. I feel a little bad doing it because I don't have inside knowledge. All I know is what we all know. You know, what happened to Gio at the World Cup. There was, you know, for whatever side you're on, it seems like we can mostly agree that there was some kind of attitude issue on his part. I'm not saying that Berhalter handled it right. It never should have become public. That's an embarrassment that it did. But this was all precipitated by an apparent attitude problem on the player's part. I don't have any background knowledge to this, but if it happened once, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that that has reared its head at other moments in his career. He's at places and he's not playing a ton. It's not unthinkable that he's expressed some kind of frustration in some way that maybe rubs a coach the wrong way and hurts his chances of getting on the field.
I wonder, would we have heard about it at Forest if it
I don't know.
Already?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it would have happened. I'm not talking post since the World Cup. I think that was kind of a learning experience on a very public scale for him.
Okay.
But in the years before that, you know, is it possible? It's possible. I don't know. That could also be unfair. I want to make a point of saying I genuinely don't know. All I know is what happened at that tournament. And I'm kind of hypothesizing that maybe it's happened at other moments too. Let's see. Any more mail? Yeah, one more piece of mail here, JJ, from Many Jack Fruit 2890. Recently read a crazy conspiracy on Twitter saying Jackie Onassis was the trigger person.
Oh, God.
They showed a slow motion clip of the shot and the angle made it look plausible. It's public knowledge she had a motive. And the government would definitely want to want that kept under wraps.
No.
But it's only a crazy theory. Yes, I would say that is a crazy theory. That is crazy. It's crazy. It's crazy. When I opened this can of worms on the last podcast, I was not expecting Jackie O as a suspect on future
I had to read it. I had to read it a couple of times. I thought it was like Jack Ruby, and then I saw no, Jackie O.
Yeah.
I think that's one that we can definitely bin and forget about.
Yeah. Yes.
But look what you've opened up. The Pandora's box now. Oh my God.
I finished the podcast when I last week when I came on, I said I had two left. I finished it. I mean, it's a certainty. It just
is. If I hear anything about jet fuel and structural steel, I will shut that. I will shut
the. Have you listened to the pod yet?
No, I'm not talking about the pod. I'm talking about if that comes up. I'm going to listen to the pod on your recommendation. I'm fascinated. Okay. I'm looking forward to it. I'm just worried about the crazy theories.
It's not
other
crazy.
Theories, but beyond JFK that you have opened up our podcast to.
No. Don't trust our listeners.
This isn't the Aaron Rodgers hour.
Let's see. So, JJ, before we close out, a couple more things I want to do here. I mentioned this before. The Athletic had their anonymous MLS GM survey. It came out yesterday, and then part two came out this morning. It's Tom Bogert, Paul Tenorio, Jeff Reuter. They do great work. I'm going to read you some of the questions that they put to the 30 GMs. Apparently, it was mostly all the GMs. There were a couple teams that put forth, I guess, somebody on like a little bit of a lower level. But decision makers, primary decision makers at every club, were asked these questions. Who will win MLS Cup? What do you think the majority said?
Inter Miami.
Yeah, 12 of them said Inter Miami. That was the most common response. Let's see. I want to ask you all these. Best move from the winter? 10. 10 of them said, do you have a guess or do you want me to tell you?
No, go on. Tell me.
Joseph Pantsill to the Galaxy. Now, it should be noted, some of them apparently answered after the season began, so they got to see his impact. Because I don't know if that would have been the unanimous. I don't know if 10 would have said that before the season.
Yeah, I like him.
Let's see.
He's played well.
Is Miami's roster build good or bad for MLS?
Bad would be the overall.
18 said good. 18 of them said good. That's a big number. One of the biggest numbers that we got for any of these responses. Now, I will read you one of the negative responses.
Please.
One that felt it was bad said, I think it's bad. I really do. One executive said, I think it's setting the league back. We fought a lot against the retirement league moniker, but now that's what people see, even in Miami with all their young talent. I don't like it. I don't like it even more because the rules are different.
He's going to love Giroud to LA Galaxy or LAFC.
Yeah, I mean they fought the retirement league moniker, but it's not gone. It's just MLS. It's just both things. They've managed to get young talent from South America while not stopping this idea that they've stopped getting old talent from Europe has always been false.
Yeah,
it's just that in addition to that, they're now also getting this thing that they weren't really getting before, which is high level young talent from South and Central America. But the old talent from Europe has not stopped. That has continued. To varying degrees of success. Like, it still does work. That's the part of the problem with MLS trying to, if they want to eliminate that, is it in their best interest to eliminate it? Because sometimes it does work very well. So we'll see. Most talented player in the league not named Messi?
Luis Suarez.
No, 8 said both Thiago Almada and Denny Bouanga. Best defender?
8 Miles Robinson.
Yes, that's right. 8 said Miles Robinson. That was the most for that. Most underrated player.
Underrated.
There were so many different answers for this one.
Oh, Giakoumakis will be in there.
Was he in there? I don't know if he was in there. 4 was the top answer for Christian Roldan.
Christian Roldan.
MLS's next player to make a big move abroad.
McGlynn.
He was, I think, 3rd on there, but 12 said Thiago Almada,
Okay. Which
is definitely absolutely the correct answer. Top coach in MLS, 18 had the same response.
Did 18 people say Tata?
No. They said Wilfried Nancy, who is pretty much who we would have said at the end of last season.
Yeah,
Jim. It's kind of when you look at the responses, it was Nancy, Jim Curtin, and then like a huge drop off. It seems like those two coaches right now are the toast of the league. JJ, you will find this one fascinating. You ready?
Go on.
Should MLS fully participate in the US Open Cup? 20 had the same response.
20 said no.
20 said yes.
Oh.
There is clearly...
So if the GMs think it can be done...
There is clearly a divide between what the teams think and what the league thinks. This is one of those moments where you can see they are not... The teams and the league or ownership are not on the same page here. One of the responses said, "We're very frustrated we're not playing," one executive said. "Of the eight teams playing, some don't want to be. For us, I don't know which team this is, 100%. It's part of the soccer ecosystem. That's what we're here for, to win trophies." Another one added, JJ, "Dude, I do this to win trophies. That's a trophy. Let's go win an effing trophy."
Oh, my God. So this is very much what we suspected. Ownership, Garber, possibly Apple, not wanting to be involved in this tournament.
But GMs, coaches, players want to be. Interesting.
So
right?
It's very interesting, and it blows a lot of arguments out that have been put forth about players and tiredness. And did they ask any question about League's Cup?
They did, as a matter of fact.
Please give me the League's Cup answer.
So that one I don't believe was broken down by the numbers that liked it or didn't like it. It was more of an abstract where there was just some quotes put in. I don't have the quotes in front of me, but the takeaway was a lot of these guys did not think it was going to resonate, and they came away from it pleasantly surprised.
Okay. All right.
That was my view of it.
But my view of it is colored by, and everybody's view is covered by, Messi. I think
he saved that tournament.
He saved the tournament. He supercharged that tournament.
Yeah.
It's a bigger tournament in my mind than the CONCACAF Champions League.
I know, it's crazy. But that is one thing that was interesting that a lot of these GMs, one of them said, and again, I wish I had the quote, but he said something to the effect of MLS performing well in that tournament and causing Liga MX teams to complain was eye-opening for them, because they said it's a sign that our leagues are now on a similar playing field, because he said these are the same complaints that we used to have when we were inferior in the CONCACAF Champions League. Oh, it's the wrong time of year. The travel's not fair. You know, all those kinds of things. They said now we're hearing Liga MX make the same complaints. It's probably a sign that the leagues have kind of leveled out and are on similar footing. So those are most, one last one. Again, there's not a number associated with this, but they asked them some opinions on the Apple deal. One of them said here, "The streaming play was the right one, and we partnered with a company that wants to be innovative," one said. And then another thing about the way the league is covered, another guy said, "Honestly, I'd like to see less Messi," one executive said. "When you open a season pass, he's all you effing see. The people who want to find him will find him."
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's basically the Gundling position.
It's true. And then Don Garber said, "Oh, the league is covered in such a lazy manner." Yeah. Oh, so it's just is messy. It? What you're pushing. So there you go. It's pretty interesting. Check out The Athletic for. I did a bunch of them, but there were still a bunch more that I didn't do there. So, if you're an MLS fan, it's worth your time. So good job by those guys.
Is there too much in this podcast that we've just done?
I like these podcasts that have like a ton of stuff.
Yeah.
Rather than just, you know, okay, we're going to just do it. Here's your Premier League pod, everybody. You know, here you go. And on that note, JJ, let's look ahead to a huge weekend in the Premier League. This is a game that is worth your time. Sunday afternoon, 11:30 a.m. Eastern time at the Etihad, Manchester City and Arsenal.
I can't wait for this one.
Yeah.
This will either be the beginning of Arsenal's march to the Premier League or the end of it.
This is an interesting opportunity for them because they're top of the table, but the perception is very much that they are the third team of a three-horse race here.
Constantly, it must be very irritating to be constantly discussed in that manner.
This is their chance. Like, I know that their fans have had it with that perception.
Yeah.
And if you want to alter perceptions, every once in a while, you're handed an opportunity to do so. This is your opportunity. Win this game. Now, it's a big ask. And by the way, they could lose and they're still part of a title race, even if they lose this game, undeniably. But if you want to convince people that you are the big dog of this race, that, you know, last year's title race has steeled you for this moment, then here you go. Like, you're not going to get a better chance than this. We'll see what the injury situation looks like. I know both Kyle Walker and John Stones did not train today for Manchester City. I think De Bruyne did. I think they have a lot of players who did come back into training. But it could be City who are a little bit more banged up in this moment than Arsenal are. So we'll see about that. One one matchup that I am utterly fascinated by for this one. Sky Sports did a good breakdown. Rodri, Declan Rice in the middle of the pitch. Two players who have kind of, I mean, they're both probably player of the season candidates this year. They do similar things. They mean, you know, they mean kind of a similar level of importance for both of their clubs. City, JJ, have not lost in the Premier League for over a year with Rodri in their team. Their only three league defeats this season have come when he was absent. Remember, he had the red card, missed a couple games, I think also with injury. So that matchup in particular is should be a fascinating one to see those two guys kind of who can boss this game more for their team.
And it's a Sky Super Sunday. Or over here, an NBC Super Sunday with Liverpool-Brighton, the first game, the early game at 9 a.m., and then City-Arsenal at 11:30 a.m. on the East Coast. That's Eastern times, obviously.
Yeah. Huge weekend.
It's every weekend now until May.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we're...
Every weekend now until May, my friend.
We're pretty much into April, right? I mean, April 1st is Monday, so... And this is it now. We're into the stretch run. But yeah, a fascinating game for those two and a real chance for Arsenal to kind of change the way people view this title race. No question about that. JJ, do you have anything else? I think I'm out.
No, I'm done. Brilliant podcast, Andrew.
Yeah.
I enjoyed, I shouldn't say that. It's up to the listeners. It's up to the listeners.
Yeah, you can have an opinion. You're part of
well,
this.
I enjoy being here for it.
Well, so do I. So do I. I should say now that I finished Masters of the Air and my JFK documentary, I've started watching, I've just forgotten the name of it. It's a new sci-fi show on Netflix.
Oh, it sounds terrible.
And I'm not always a huge science fiction person, but I saw some reviews of this that were very good. And I started it, Three Body Problem, it's called. I saw some reviews that were intriguing. I thought, oh, let's give it a shot. And I'm so ridiculously in.
Three Body Problem.
I'm so in. It's a Benioff and Weiss, the guys who did Game of Thrones. It's another one of theirs. And
all right, I'll give it a spin.
Yeah.
Once I get through my Band of Brothers rewatch.
There you go. So yeah, if anyone's curious, that's what I've moved on to, and I think it's fantastic. JJ, I got nothing else. Our thanks to Chris Whittingham for joining us earlier in the show to talk a little U.S. men's national team. Hey, that's about it on my end, JJ. To you, I say,
check you later, fun boy.
I'll see you.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.